And so Omaganad Timadandra Sadhanjanas Lakaya Chakshura Militam Yena Tasmai Shikarve Namaha. So one of the topics we were discussing was, what is Vedic? So it's very interesting. Of course, the word Vedic really means, or Veda means knowledge. And there's another word related to that, which is Vedanta, which means the ultimate conclusion of knowledge. And there's things related like Sanatana Dharma, the eternal Dharma of the living entity. So all these different concepts are related. So sometimes we take things that are not eternal or not even coming from traditional Indian, what we call Vedic India. All right, let's talk about Vedic India. Vedic India means something like 5,000 years ago, during the time of Maharaj Yudhisthira and the Pandavas and all those other nice personalities. And of course, Vedic India, or India, was far more, far larger than it is today. It's described that Maharaj Yudhisthira was the emperor of the whole world. And it's interesting if you note the marriage of Dhritarashtra. Who was Dhritarashtra married to? You don't remember?
Gandhari.
So you know where she came from?
Kandahar.
Kandahar, Afghanistan, where the Taliban is today. I mean, this is way before that particular religion was founded. So anyway, so she came from, she was an Afghanese girl. Really interesting. And so India was very, very large at that particular point. It was, you know, Bart Varsha meant the whole world, basically, not just the little tract of land. And later on, it began carved up. And Prabhupada commented on this. He said, there was Pakistan, and then you have all these other stands around there. You know, Uzbekistan, Pakistan, Tajikistan, all these stands. And they were all part of India originally. And Prabhupada was commenting that one day the Punjab will want to break away and call it Punjabistan or something like that.
Khalistan.
What?
Khalistan.
Yeah, that's... So at that time, you know, things were rather Vedic and they were following Varnashram. They didn't have the caste system. And so nowadays, we really have a misunderstanding of... And of course, ultimately, before I mention that, Vedic means to be, understand Krishna. As Krishna says in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, by all the Vedas I am to be known. Because if you don't have Krishna there, you're not Vedic. You can have everything else that you consider to be Vedic, which probably is not. And which we're going to talk about in a second. But you're not Vedic without Krishna. That's it. You know. So... nowadays, we consider a lot of things to be Vedic. One of the things I was talking about this morning in class was interesting. People talk about Vedic architecture. Isn't it? Architecture. When the devotees were planning the temple of the Vedic planetarium, which is called TOVP, in case some of you don't know what it is, they were discussing what type of architecture to have. Prabhupada himself wanted the temple modeled after, interestingly enough, the Capitol building in the United States. And the devotees, many devotees, got upset, not with Prabhupada, of course, but upset with the present plans of the temple, thinking, let's have something Vedic. But actually, we don't know what Vedic architecture is, because there's no remnants of it right now. It's very interesting. Because most of the architecture you find in India is a mixture of different cultures. Like if you go to Bengal, there's Bengali architecture, and which is influenced to a large extent by the Muslim invasion. Because if you go to Baghdad, you'll see many similar types of buildings there. And also East India, West India. And South India, you have some buildings that are very old. Like we were visiting Sri Rangam, for example, and there's this hall of 1,000 pillars that's literally, I think it's almost 2,000 years old. The ancient South Indian devotees called the Alwars. Some of you have heard about them before? You remember that. The Alwars, they actually met there. And it's interesting, another point is that some of the Alwars were ladies. Nowadays, of course, you have so much chauvinism in the name of being Vedic. That's another issue that I don't have time to talk about tonight. That's a whole other course I'm giving in Fiji. I'm going to give a course in Fiji, the position of women in Krishna consciousness. Try to change everybody's consciousness from the chauvinism, slave, stay in the kitchen consciousness to you know, Krishna consciousness. Japati consciousness. So anyway, so you go to South India to Sri Rangam, and you have this hall of 1,000 pillars. The Alwars would meet there. And the architecture there is just flat. It's just a flat building, you know, just flat roof with 1,000 pillars in it. And that would be probably the closest thing to ancient architecture that you actually still have in India. Or sometimes you even have these caves where the sages would meet and they're carved out. The Ajanta Caves. You've heard about that before? The Ajanta Caves in India. So it's really hard to figure out what is Vedic architecture. And as far as what is Vedic food, that's also hard to figure out too, because when Krishna was present, they didn't have sugar cane there. I hate to tell you that. Of course, in Fiji, I can't speak about this because one of the main sources of money in Fiji is the sugar cane industry, where they're giving everybody diabetes all around the world. So, anyway, I better be careful, because nobody wants to eat the feast later on. So there was no sugar cane. So, I mean, they had sweeteners like honey. And actually, they even made honey wine. Did you know that? There's stories about Krishna and the gopis getting drunk. So it's bona fide. Not for devotees, but for Krishna and the gopis. And they got so drunk on honey wine that when they tried to pour more wine into the glass was upside down, so they poured the wine on top of the, you know, the part that holds the glass up instead of the bottom, you know, the actual container of glass. So do we really know what is Vedic food? I mean, even we talk about halva. You know that where that word came from? That's Middle Eastern. That's a Middle Eastern dish. It's not actually something that was present in Krishna's time 5,000 years ago. You never hear about Yudhisthira Maharaj sitting down and eating a plate of halva. So, but we do know there was milk because Krishna is a coward boy. That's why he's called Gopal, Govinda. So there was plenty of milk. And there were milk products, and there was butter. How do we know that? Because Krishna was stealing it. He's Makan Chor, is one of the names of Krishna. So we knew certain things, but we really don't know, you know, whether the recipes we have in the Krishna Consciousness Movement are from that time. But does that mean they're non-Vedic? No. Because the word Veda means, basically, knowledge, and to be Vedic means something to please Krishna. That's really what it means. It's not in reference to a particular style of architecture or a particular type of vegetarian food. I mean, maybe in the spiritual world, Krishna eats pizza too. Sometimes I'm giving class to a lot of people from India and I ask them, what is your favorite food? Practically everyone says pizza. I said, well, what about your Indian dishes? He said, no, we like pizza best. So it's interesting. I mean, this whole concept of being, of what Vedic is. So Veda means to know Krishna, to please Krishna, and to follow what's called Sanatan Dharma. So I said I would speak about that. So Sanatan Dharma means the eternal constitutional nature of the living entity. It's not just another religion, another tradition, another ethnic group like that. You know, many times people follow the religion based on ethnic groups. Even in India, you know, it's like that. That different parts of India, if you go to Gujarat, you may find a lot of Swami Narayan followers. And, of course, they broke up into two groups, you know, the Swami Narayan, the Bops, anyway. And then if you go to certain places. Then people worship Durga. Like in Bengal, they have Durga Puja, which is really a big festival. So this is not Sanatana Dharma. Sanatana Dharma, the word Dharma comes from the root D, which means that which sustains a thing, which never changes. Like Prabhupada gave the example at the, and that's also is Bhaktivinoda Thakur's example from the Jiva Dharma, that the Dharma of water is liquidity. But when the water is in an unnatural situation, then it becomes solid. But that's an unnatural situation. It comes in contact with something that causes it to assume anicca, a non-eternal or non-dharmic state. So we're the jiva souls, and we've come in contact with something. What is that? That's the material nature, the three modes of nature, karanam, guna, sangasya, sadasa, jama, jonichu, that causes us to be in an unnatural state, a state of craziness. Like Prabhupada would say, you know, who's actually crazy? And actually, everyone in the material world is crazy. Just like if you go into a mental institution and someone says, I'm Napoleon, or I don't know what they say in Australia, because they wouldn't think of Napoleon. But, you know, I'm God. You find a lot of gods in the mental institution, and also in some spiritual institutions coming from India. But anyway, I'm God, you're God, we're all God. What a crazy thing to say. So, in a mental institution, I mean, it's obviously crazy, but people walking around thinking they're the body is just as crazy as a mental institution. For me to think, you know, I'm a 66-year-old, you know, American or whatever, it's crazy. It's insanity. It's like today we were driving around in a Lexus, so for me to think I'm a Lexus is insanity. Isn't it? Of course, it's a better insanity than driving around in a Volkswagen. So, I mean, different degrees of worse insanity. What's the worst car you have here?
Mostly Korean or Chinese.
Which one, the Kia?
Great Wall.
The what?
Great Wall.
Great Wall?
Yeah.
Oh my God, sounds like a Chinese car. And in Europe we have this car called the Yugo, which is actually, it's like that old movie, The Flintstones, I don't know if you've seen it, where you have to stick your feet under the car. And that's how you make the car move. It's so bad. I don't know if anyone saw that cartoon when they were young. So, it's insanity. So, therefore, we're concerned with the eternal things rather than these temporary, you know, things that are not sanatan. And we're concerned with the process of devotional service, the sadhana bhakti and bhava bhakti, prema bhakti, which are actually all eternal things. And we're concerned with our own eternal nature, you know, who we are in the spiritual world, reviving our nature. Because originally we were in the spiritual world. We weren't born or didn't appear at a particular point. But we were originally Krishna conscious living entities, as Prabhupada said. So this is actually what Vedic means. So we have to be careful how we use this word. Another point is that if we go to the university and we tell people we're Vedic, the professors who are Indologists, that means people who study India or Indian culture, will think we're crazy. Why? Because they have a different definition of what Vedic means. Their definition is that Vedic means people follow the original four Vedas. Like the Arya Samaj. You've heard of the Arya Samaj before? Arya Samaj, Brahma Samaj, Dayananda Saraswati, who was the origin of the Arya Samaj. They only follow the four Vedas. And they don't like the other stuff, like the Itihasas, the histories, the Puranas, you know, the Bhagavad Purana, and all those other literatures. And they also don't believe that Krishna existed. They believe the ultimate God is formless, meaningless, nameless, and they don't like deities either. At least these strict Arya Samajis. Some of them eat meat, and they think they're Vedic. And what they do is they chant the Gayatri Mantra. They think they're Vedic by chanting the Gayatri Mantra, the first one, the Brahma Gayatri, and doing fire sacrifices on a daily basis. And they think they're Vedic. So this is the general academic understanding what Vedic means. However, the Vedas, even the four original Vedas, don't have that understanding. There's this verse in the Rig Veda, which is actually contained several times in the four original Vedas. Itihasa Purananam Panchama Veda Uchate. Anyone's heard that verse before? You were in my class this morning, you've heard it. That means the Rig Veda says that there's this Panchama Veda, the fifth, you know, Panch, fifth Veda. And the fifth Veda is the Itihasas, the histories. Histories means like Ramayana, Mahabharata, these are all histories. And then Itihasa Purananam, and the Puranas, like the Bhagavad Purana, the Karma Purana, the Padma Purana, and you know, there's 18 main Puranas, six in each mode of nature, or dealing with people in the different modes of nature. The Puranas are all transcendental. And so the Rig Veda says that these are considered the fifth Veda. In other words, the Rig Veda says these are part of the Vedic understanding, as well as, of course, that includes the Upanishads and the Aranyaka literatures. I'm not going to get into describing all these different literatures. So, in any case, those literatures are Vedic, especially the Srimad Bhagavatam, because the Srimad Bhagavatam has been passed down in disciplic succession by our gurus, and it's been passed down in untouched form. So that's the main literature that we take shelter of. And in fact, it's mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam itself that in this age of Kali, it's the Bhagavad Purana that protects the religious principles that disappeared when Krishna left this planet. And, you know, there's that question by the sages. By who are religious principles protected now that the Lord has left this world? And famous verse that the Bhagavatam protects these religious principles. So this is Vedic. And we can be Vedic. Here comes an advertisement of Krishna West. Anyway, we can be Vedic even wearing Western clothes. You know, it's not that because you put on pants you're no longer Vedic. And it's not that because you're wearing a dhoti you're Vedic. I mean, there's plenty of people who wear dhotis who are... I mean, I think Ravana wore a dhoti also. So, so yeah, it's not necessarily true that because you wear a dhoti in a sari, you're spiritual or Vedic or anything like that. So we are interested in the change in consciousness. And that occurs through the chanting of the Lord's holy name. These are all Vedic things. So we have to be able to see, we can use non-Vedic things or things that may or may not be Vedic, architecture, whatever, to please Krishna. Like Prabhupada exhibited this principle of yukta vairagya, using plenty of things that were obviously not Vedic. I mean, a microphone is not Vedic, a camera is not Vedic, a car is not Vedic. I mean, if you really wanted to be Vedic, you'd have to come here. Like one time I was with Prabhupada, and Prabhupada, this was in Dallas, Texas, and Prabhupada said that I came here by airplane, but I could have come by magic carpet or mantra. It was actually funny, you know, the devotees were just shocked. We were sitting with Prabhupada. I had arranged this whole interview that Prabhupada had with some reporters in Dallas, Texas, in the airport. There's actually a video of some of it. And it was amazing. It was in the VIP room. And practically the first thing Prabhupada said is, you know, I could have come by magic carpet or by mantra. And the reporters and the devotees were like, wow, magic carpet, you know. That's something out of the Arabian Nights. Have you ever read 1001 Arabian Nights? Yeah. So, just imagine a devotee coming to a magic carpet. So then the reporter asked Prabhupada, you know, why did you come by this American Airlines, it was called. And Prabhupada said, well, just to be one with you. That was Prabhupada's response. Because that was the advertising motto of American Airlines: be one with us and fly with us. So Prabhupada was making a play on those particular words. Prabhupada was very humorous. I mean, and even when he was in the airplane, you know, he was just like, Prabhupada was very, even sarcastic humor sometimes. You know, like Prabhupada flew one airline, there was one airline called Pacific Standard Airline, and the stewardesses did not dress too chastely, and Prabhupada called the airline, he told the devotees, he used to say this airline is prostitute standard airline. PSA, you know, same thing. So, so anyway, Prabhupada said, you know, to be one with you. So Prabhupada was indicating that flying in an airplane to please Krishna is just as Vedic as flying by mantra. It's interesting, isn't it? Why? Because it's all Krishna's energy. It's meant to be used for Krishna or by for Krishna's service. Just like we hear, Ishavashamidam sabram yakincha jagjam jagat tena jatena bunjata magritha kashasvidanam, that everything's owned and controlled by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everyone's given a quota and everything's meant to be used for Krishna. So if you're using things for Krishna under the direction of Krishna's pure devotee, you're Vedic. You're Vedic. And so, you know, if you're doing something to make more devotees, and they're actually chanting Hare Krishna and taking up the regular principles and everything like that, that's Vedic. It's very interesting. So that was the discussion we had this morning, because there's a lot of controversy. In ISKCON, as in any organization, we have conservatives, liberals, and liberals. Just like in the government, you have conservative and liberals here. We have a conservative party and a liberal party in ISKCON. So Prabhupada said that the devotees should meet together at the GBC meeting and discuss how to do unity and diversity. So to respect each other for different opinions on how to spread Krishna consciousness, as long as we keep within the Boundary Acharya's directions, you know, chanting 16 rounds, we can't adjust certain things. We can't say, well, just chant one round a day every week, or, you know, we'll chant one round a week or something, and, you know, you can be initiated. You know, 16 rounds a day, you know, tilak and different things like that. Yeah, as long as we stick within Prabhupada's instructions, then we're connected like that. And then we have to use our intelligence how to spread Krishna consciousness. Like Prabhupada used his intelligence how to spread Krishna consciousness in a strange country that's called America. And he did things that even his godbrothers disapproved of. You know, he had ladies living in the Brahmacharini ashram. He gave us malachas, you know, initiation, you know, Brahman thread initiation. He gave sannyas to people from the Western world. And even Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur gave people sannyas and Brahman initiation when they were from a lower caste. And they tried to kill him because of that. The conservatives in India, They actually took out a, you know, like in the mafia, they paid someone to kill him, and they even paid the policeman to look the other way, and the police chief came to Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and he said, look, normally there's no problem getting people killed. This is not a problem for me, because this is our business. But because you're a great saintly person, I don't want to take part in that particular activity. So you find this all the time. So Prabhupada did things that many of his godbrothers criticized. In fact, one of his godbrothers said, all Bhaktivedanta Swami was successful because he liked to associate with the lower class people, which is an offense against Prabhupada. Prabhupada tolerated us and did so many things that even his godbrothers didn't approve of. And Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur did the same thing. One example is that when he was inviting English dignitaries to Sridhar Mayapur to preach to them, he even made arrangement so they could have cigarettes and even meat if they wanted to. And he told the devotees, he said, I would even roll their cigarettes. For them. At that time, they didn't sell cigarettes like that. They do now. He had to roll them. So, I mean, because he was willing to shed gallons of blood. This is how much compassion. How much compassion Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur had, that he was willing to shed gallons of blood to bring people to Krishna consciousness. I mean, there's another story about that. All these stories come to mind. That once upon a time, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur arrived at a temple to do a deity installation to install Radha and Krishna. So he arrived there, and he noticed that there was one devotee who was a little crazy, who the devotees had kicked out of the temple. Just because, you know, he's a little eccentric. Let's not use the word crazy. Devotee's never crazy, just eccentric. Just challenged. Isn't it? emotionally challenged. So, just like you say, if someone's fat, they're horizontally challenged. So he's someone is short, he's vertically challenged. What's called politically correct language nowadays. So anyway, so he came there and they had kicked this devotee out, and Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur asked, you know, where's this devotee? And they said, well, we have to kick out. He was creating problems. And Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, I'm not going to do any deity installation here. I'm leaving. You get that devotee back here, or I'm leaving. You know, so much compassion he had. So that's really what should be the guiding light for our particular activities, you know, compassion. Not to deviate from Krishna consciousness, but to follow the footsteps of acharyas, and utilize our intelligence in bringing people to Krishna's lotus feet. So that's the point. And that's Vedic. Anyway, so that's what I want as my lesson for today. So any questions or comments? That was it. Basically, that was somewhat of the class I gave this morning in Brisbane, but I elaborated more on it. Yeah.
Maharaj, I did some study of Vedic architecture.
Yeah.
I got a book from the library about the last 6,000 years of, of building. And it said that the courtyard is the basis of...
The central courtyard. That's...
Yeah, of...
Vastu, yeah, that's Vastu.
Architecture, yeah. So the court, there's courtyard buildings in China, over the Middle East. Ancient Rome, ancient Greece, they all had courtyards. And they compared that, they call it Occidental, compared to Western.
Western.
Which doesn't have courtyards.
Yeah, the reason they had courtyards is because the weather was good, the open courtyards. Like you see in our Vrindavan temple, and in many of the temples, because Mayapur doesn't have an open courtyard, is what, because the weather is so good, you can have an open courtyard, and you can have the deity viewing room somewhere else. So you have to understand that it was very functional because of the weather, the climate there, with the open courtyard. Whereas if you go to the very far north, like Vardarika Ashram, then you have a different style of architecture. You follow what I'm saying?
I haven't been to that.
Yeah, it's a different style because of the climate. The climate there. So, and the temple of Mayapur, I guess you could say it's a courtyard. I don't know how you'd say it, a courtyard. It's a big dome. And there's a big area where you can fit how many people? 5,000 people at once in front of the deities. And Prabhupada preferred that particular architectural standard rather than anything else. And that's Vedic. The point is, you may find some, we're talking about Vedic. You may find some evidence of ancient Indian architecture, but the word Vedic means something connected with Krishna. So even modern architecture can be just as Vedic, just like we're sitting in a house that's modern. If you use this house for Krishna, it's Vedic. Because the word Veda doesn't refer to a particular style of architecture. The word Veda refers to knowledge and the conclusion of knowledge. And there's the principle of yukta vairagya. So it's not necessarily true that if I'm in a particular style of building, that I'll be more Krishna conscious than another style of building. I mean, the greatest devotees of the Lord, the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, were living in like little rooms, square rooms, you know, bhajan kutirs, and just absorb. And Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was living in the Gambira. So the whole point is to be absorbed in Krishna and to do the needful, yukta vairagya. Yukta vairagya means to use things in Krishna's service to be able to please Krishna. And that means, you know, this, like this phone can be Vedic. Even though it's not from ancient India, I know, because they didn't need these things. They had, they could communicate by other means. They didn't need this. I mean, obviously, it's not traditional. There's a difference between traditional and Vedic. So this phone, I'm using it for Krishna, I hope. And right now I'm recording the class on the phone and communicating with all people around the world about Krishna. So it's Vedic. It's a Vedic phone.
Be careful with Niyamagra also.
Yeah. Yeah, taking too much. I mean, obviously, we can't turn everything into Vedic if we're not using it for Krishna or inventing something. But we're using so many things for Krishna. Modern science, microfilm, everything. And that's really what Vedic means. So there may be traditional architecture. I'm not denying what you're saying. There is traditional architecture. But Vedic means using something for Krishna. Yeah.
So Maharaj, if everything can be classed as Vedic, if it's used in the service of Krishna...
Used properly under the direction of Krishna's pure devotees.
Architecture, food, clothes, etc.
Yeah.
Then is there any sense to worry about the original sort of Vedic things, or should we try and bring those things in as well as much as possible?
It depends on where you are in the world. It really depends on where you are. I mean, Prabhupada himself wasn't so concerned about that. Prabhupada was concerned about Dharma and, you know, the truth of the universes and Krishna's pastimes. You don't find the Acharyas so concerned about these things. I mean, our Vaishnava Acharyas. I mean, they're Vastu Acharyas who are concerned about these things. But the Vaishnava Acharyas, you really don't find them writing about this at all. I mean, if you look at the writings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, they're not writing so much about the dress, except, you know, the Babaji dress, which is kind of nice. Save a lot of money on clothes. But, I mean, that's Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes about that in many of his books, about the Babajis and dress, you know, anyway. So, mainly they're writing about the Siddhanta, you know, the conclusion of Krishna consciousness. I don't find them spending so much time. Even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, when he took sannyas, he gave up his study and propagation of astrology. You know, but sometimes we have a habit of getting more into these things than our acharyas have. Mm-hmm. I mean, we get into astrology, and there was one devotee who published a really nice book. They said, how to use astrology to ruin your life. You know, I'm not saying astrology is bad, but, you know, you go to an astrologer, the astrologer says, you're going to have some spiritual trouble here. I can see for the next 5-7 years, you're in your Saturn period, Dwarka, you know. You're going to really be struggling. And, you know, in your relationship with your wife, it's going to be horrible for the next 7 years. So there's something called the self-fulfilling prophecy. You've heard about that before? Or the power of suggestion. Like, even that works with our doctors here, it's an interesting point. Like, there's been some studies that when the emergency medical technicians find someone, if they say there's no hope, he's not going to survive, there's less hope that he will survive just by them saying that. Did you know that? Because he's just, I'm going to die. So you have this, the power of suggestion. I mean, anyone who's studied hypnotism knows about this. You can give someone a suggestion. Subliminal suggestion. There was an interesting book many years ago called The Hidden Persuaders. Anyone read that book? No. That book was talking about how people were manipulated by the media to buy certain things or to do certain things. They had a study done in the movie theater where they would just flash one frame of buy popcorn in front of everybody. And you couldn't see it. It was subliminal. So subliminal means below the level of your being able to perceive it. And so when they flashed that, the popcorn sales went up by double. And people didn't even know. They just had the power of suggestion. So anyway, so you don't find our acharyas getting into that much. You know, Prabhupada sometimes said, you know, let's hear what the horoscope says. Let's have a good laugh about the thing. You know, when am I supposed to leave the body? You know, like that. But it's not that they change their whole lives for that. So we tend to get into these external things. Prabhupada actually said that's for karmis anyway. We get into these external things that keep us away from focusing ourselves on the real purpose of life. The real purpose of life is how to chant Hare Krishna purely. How to bring others to Krishna consciousness, how to please our spiritual master, how to be absorbed in Krishna's pastimes, how to realize our spiritual identity. I mean, I got enough to do without thinking about other things, isn't it? I mean, if you take all of our goals, which we just mentioned, some of them, you know, realizing spiritual identity, loving Krishna, pleasing the spiritual master, spreading the movement, then that doesn't leave us time for anything else. You know, some time for eating and sleeping. Not much. Not much. So it's good we don't get in, you know, we maximize our human form of life to do what's, do the Sanatana Dharma, rather than to get into so many things that may not be directly Sanatana Dharma. Of course, we can use things. I mean, it's like we're dressed in dhotis and everything like that, because that helps us with have a sense of self-identification. You know, any group has a certain way to identify, a certain handshake. There's something like secret handshake. We should have a secret handshake in the Krishna conscious movement. So you know who's actually a devotee. Or certain mudras or things like that. But, you know, any group has those means of identification. And, you know, of course, we have our neck beads. That's actually Vedic, because it's mentioned by the Acharyas. If you have neck beads, then the Yamadutas stay away from you. Pretty good. So, I guess you had a question, real quick?
Maharaj, there was that story of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj when he entered Vrindavan in a big limousine in the 1920s.
Yeah, like a Rolls Royce or something.
Leather shoes.
Yeah.
And all the local Babaji's, you know, were incensed that what sort of sannyas is this? And he said, I've come here to drive all the nonsense white ladies out of Vrindavan.
Yeah. He was showing the principle of Yukta Vairagya and also trying to shock them. You know, shock them that, you know, in this day and age, you're not simply just meant to sit down and chant. In this day and age, you are meant to go out and preach. And actually, there's one interesting poem written by Prabhupada that really brings this point out more than anything else I've ever read. It's the poem is called Vrindavan Bhajan. Anyone's heard of that poem or read that poem? I've made reference to it before. And in this poem, Prabhupada actually says, if you're simply sitting down and think you're going to become... I'm paraphrasing. You know, I wish I could read it, because I don't have a copy with me right now. But Prabhupada said, someone who thinks they're becoming Krishna conscious in such a way without going out and preaching, they're eating the mind's bananas. And, you know, that means, you know, bananas. If you say someone's bananas, you understand what that expression means. That they're off their rocker or something. So, you know, so our business is to spread Krishna. You know, we should be super enthusiastic, like Prabhupada. He was overcome with compassion for the conditioned soul, for all of us. You know, Prabhupada was so much overcome with compassion that at his age, he did what he did. You know, he risked his life. You know, we all know, because it was just Prabhupada's appearance day, and now it's the 50th anniversary, we're coming up on ISKCON. But Prabhupada just did things that were so... At his age, I mean, just like right now, I'm approaching the age that Prabhupada came to America at. You know, I'm approaching very quickly, too quickly. So I'm approaching that age, and I'm thinking, what? How could I do that? You know, someone said, go with no money to a strange country where you don't know anybody, and you have to go by boat, and you're having a heart attack. I said, well, find someone else. You know, because when you get this age, it's, you know, you're just not as spry as you were when you were young. Although we're going to climb a mountain the next year. Not warning you, we're going to climb Mount Warner. But anyway, so. But still, you know, just the thought of it, you know, when I go someplace and I want to make sure I have all my plane tickets, credit cards, mobile phone with all the local SIM cards. You know, I have a local Australian SIM card in here. I want to make sure that, you know, I'm covered. All the bases are covered. You know, I wouldn't take any chances that, you know, if someone doesn't come immediately, you know, I just had arrived in Brisbane and they weren't there at the airport. And I was just like frantically calling on the phone. Calling, Kishori, where are they? You know, just practically yelling at her. So could you imagine, you know, Prabhupada went there, he didn't know which direction to turn, he came to America. No mobile phones, obviously there weren't any at that time. And then, you know, finally he found Traveler's Aid. Finally he took a bus. Devotees don't even take buses anymore. They're too sophisticated, isn't it? He took a bus to Butler, Pennsylvania. He lived in someone's house, and the person was eating meat. And preached, you know, some places like that. Then finally came to New York and had to live in such situations. Didn't even have a place for the bathroom. He was living in a little tiny place, and there wasn't even a bathroom there. He had to go somewhere else for that. And that was Prabhupada's compassion. So he should be our role model. That's the point. I mean, we shouldn't... Prabhupada said the Vaishnavas will not be satisfied until everybody is Krishna conscious. And that was Prabhupada's vision, to make the whole world Krishna, not just a few people in an ashram Krishna conscious, but to change the face of the world. Tadvag visarga janataga vipabho yasmin pratishlagma padavachati namananta shri shokani katani yat shrinvanti gayanti grinanti yat sadavaha. You know the verse? That this literature, the Bhagavatam, is meant to create a revolution in the misdirected lives of an impious civilization. And even if things are done a little bit, you know, improperly composed or something, which Prabhupada quoted in that particular way, then it is glorified like that. So Prabhupada, so we are meant to take Prabhupada as our role model. I was talking about this the other day, that we all have role models. People we want to be like. That's what got me to join the Hare Krishna movement. Not so much... The style of dress did not encourage me to join the Hare Krishna movement, nor the bald head. Because in those days, everybody, you know, it was the 1960s, we all had long hair. I looked like Satya Sai Baba. A younger version of Satya Sai Baba. So, I mean, everybody, even the businessmen, they had long shoulder-length hair in the 1960s. If you had short hair, there was something wrong with you. You probably, you know, a criminal or something, or just weird, crazy. So, you know, so seeing Prabhupada got me to do something that I didn't want to do, join the Hare Krishna movement. So, eventually I did want to do it, but anyway. Seeing Prabhupada, I mean, so that's the role model. That's what we get inspired by. We're inspired by people. You know, someone who's so compassionate and so, you know, transcendental, whatever. I mean, I could tell you about my experiences with Prabhupada. I mean, just, it was like going back to the spiritual world just to be in the physical presence of Prabhupada. That's the important thing. So, all right, any other questions? No comments? Or problems? Yeah.
Acharyas are more concerned with time, place, and circumstances yeah. than anything else.
Yeah.
Because then they can adjust rather than just holding to, you know, Niyam Agra full time and
yeah, I mean, you see that with Bhakti Vinod Thakur, with Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and with all the Acharyas. Basically all the Acharyas, they were concerned with time, place, and circumstance. I mean, our Acharyas did so many amazing things. Like this, who was that Acharya who vowed, I think it was Rasikananda, who vowed to accept the first person he met that day as a disciple. And so there was a body that came floating in from the ocean, and he touched the body with his feet and brought the body back to life and said, "You're my disciple." I mean, that's a pretty good preaching technique. We can go into the cemetery. What do they say? Those bones shall rise again. You know, that's a Christian saying. A resurrection. So I mean, devotees are willing to do whatever is necessary to make people Krishna conscious within the purview of the regulative principles and the acharya's instructions. You know, we have to strain our mind. Prabhupada said we have to strain our mind to bring people to Krishna consciousness. Rupa.
Moses, it seems to be a bit of a danger, although, you know, you can be a devotee in any dress.
Yeah.
Seems to be a bit of danger, you know, like that, you know, as the years have gone on, we've adopted a lot of Western dress as well. Devotees wear a lot of Western dress, and it's to the point where I can speak for, you know, New Govardhan. A lot of devotees, they, you know, they're always in Western dress, they're never in Dhoti and Kurta. Even like when they every time they might be in Dhoti and Kurta at the temple, but you know, they get changed to go into town to do the shopping, they get changed into plain clothes. They're not thinking, oh, you know, if I stay in Dhanakuta or Sari, so many people will see me and it'll make them think Hare Krishna. You know?
Yeah, but utility is the principle. I mean, certain places, then it's good. Mm-hmm. And other places, like if you're in an Arab country, it's not such a good idea. So you have to consider what's best. My point is to consider what's best to bring people to Krishna consciousness, whether it's dressed in a dhoti. And also another thing is, even if people are dressed in Western clothes or other types of clothes, they should dress nicely. One problem is when devotees don't dress in a dhoti, sometimes they dress so sloppily they come to the temple with shorts on. That's actually very disrespectful. Very disrespectful. The whole point is Prabhupada wanted us either to dress in this traditional dress, or to dress as ladies and gentlemen. I mean, it's respectful. I mean, you wouldn't find a Christian going into a church on Sunday with shorts. I mean, in Fiji, of course, they have these sulus, which are sort of like a version of shorts. But that's considered the dress-up for them. That's a different culture. But you won't find someone like messy coming into a temple or a church. So we should have that same respect when we go to see the deities, that we should dress nicely, cleanly, respectfully. And you see that, you know, sometimes I go into Christian churches just to see what they're doing and to hear the music, because they get, some of them have pretty good music. And just like I just attended a whole performance by this Hillsong Church. Anyone's heard of the Hillsong Church? Yeah, and it was really nice. A little loud, but it was really nice. You know, I like that. So you see, everybody's dressed respectfully when you go in there. It's just very nice. It creates a... I'm not saying they're all a mode of goodness, but it's a mode of goodness attitude. If people are dressed respectfully. So if someone doesn't dress in a dhoti, or sorry, whatever, they should dress in some nice, respectable way. Because the whole concept is to be clean and respectful towards Krishna. So that's why I have dhotis. I mean, dhotis are good because they're simple. Simple and clean. I mean, I like it. I like them. But sometimes, you know, for practical purposes, I may dress in Western clothes. You know, particularly if I'm going to Saudi Arabia to preach Krishna consciousness, then you definitely have to dress in Western clothes. Or even if I'm going into Singapore, where there's plenty of devotees, because they won't let me in as a devotee. Even you have to take your neck beads off and just lower them down. So the whole point is being practical. Whatever helps people remember Krishna. Because the first rule is what? Always remember Krishna. And the second rule is what? Never forget Krishna. So I just want to be like that. I'll use whatever technology, and that's Vedic, to always remember Krishna. Okay? A little controversy. Not too much. I'm not that controversial. So any other questions from anyone here? So in other words, you don't have to feel forced to dress in a certain way to be a Hare Krishna devotee. Or, you know, if you don't happen to like certain types of food, you can still be a devotee. For example, I've refined my diet. When I first joined, of course, the movement, I was eating sweet rice, halva, pakoras, and everything like that. And now I literally can't eat those things anymore. But it's not that I blew from the Hare Krishna movement. Because I have a healthy diet. You say, oh, Maharaj, now you've deviated from Krishna consciousness. You're no longer Vedic. You know, you've left. We have to report this to the GBC, you know, that you don't eat halva anymore. Actually, probably most of the GBC don't eat halva anymore. Because we're all getting old. It's like an old people's home now. You go to the GBC. You know, the senior citizens, they wheel us into the GBC meeting. So, you know, Krishna consciousness means being practical. Being utility is the principle, as Prabhupada said. Purity is the force. Utility is the principle. Certain things we don't change. We chant Hare Krishna. We have to chant with devotion. Avoid the 10 offenses. I mean, these things don't. These things are completely set in stone. So, No other questions? We got a lot of people here. Is it prasadam now? Or? So I'm very happy to be here. Yes.
Maharaj, is it necessary for a sannyas to travel all around the world?
No, not necessary. Like Prabhupada sometimes said, to one sannyasi, he said, you should stay in one place, because he had some responsibility. Another sannyasi said, you should travel. The present situation of sannyasis traveling around the world is not really the best thing, because you accomplish less. I mean, just what, like my life is not ideal in one sense, because really to manage a movement, things should be rather contiguous, geographically contiguous. And I happen to be the GBC of Fiji, the GBC of parts of Europe, and GBC of parts of the United States, which is really an impractical thing. So it's better in the long run. Right now we have a temporary situation. In the long run, people should be in one geographical area. They can travel within a geographical area and they can accomplish more and be able to train up, like sannyasi has disciples. You can spend time training the disciples up. There's only so much you can do over the internet with email and, you know, and Skype and everything like that. So we're in a non-traditional or even in a long-term impractical situation right now. So your point is well taken. It's well taken. It's actually, in the future, you won't see the same thing.
I'm just thinking, you know, paying for travel all around the world is quite expensive, isn't
yeah.
it?
Well, I travel very cheaply. I go in the baggage compartment. I have some devotee check me in as freight, and then I come
out. You should be going by sea.
But I never travel first class or anything like that. And I spend, you know, Dowji asked me, you know, who gets your tickets? And I said, I spend a lot of time on the internet just finding the cheapest flight. And that's how I'm able to go to all these different places. And, you know, the people help with the fares when I go to places, they give donations and that helps. But it's better for a person to be in one geographical area. I agree 100% with that. And you'll see, we're changing the structure of the zones right now, so that will happen in the future. I mean, the whole reason I'm here in Australia is that I was asked by Tamal Krishna Maharaj to become the GBC of Fiji. This is before he passed away. He asked me to become the GBC of Fiji, and, you know, me being enthusiastic to travel, I said, okay, Jai. And because I liked the prasadam there. And I didn't understand his second point that he made to me. He said, I said to him, I said, the prasadam in Fiji is fantastic, the best cooks in the world. And he said, yes, the prasadam is very tasty, and the politics is even more tasty in Fiji. So I thought, oh, he's just joking. But I found out later it was the absolute truth, you know, Sanatana Dharma. So, you know, I sort of got, I mean, I think most of the GBC got roped in like that, but we're restructuring for the next generation that think people will only have a contiguous zone. You know, someone may have a small area to travel, but there'll still be some traveling. But like someone would be in Australia. We actually broke Australia up into, I think, three different zones, which is interesting. And then there's the South Pacific area. You know, there's a whole structure that we've done on the GBC. And like, you know, America has like six different zones or something like that. So that people remain contiguous. But right now we're just doing the needful, which is not ultimately the most efficient, effective way to function. You're right, absolutely. Absolutely, I really appreciate that. And we've come to that realization too. But, you know, in the beginning, sometimes you have to do things that are not, like Prabhupada was traveling all around the world, so. And then also, you know, we also had Prabhupada disciples, which you're not going to have around for a lot longer. So the devotees want to see Prabhupada disciples. You know, it's a special, I don't want to say it's a special status, but it's what it is. You know, people who are directly trained up by Prabhupada, directly work with Prabhupada. So there's, you know, there's something special too. So I think next generation, things will get normalized in our movement. Which is like you see in the Catholic Church. You don't have a bishop that's in charge of one continent and goes to another continent, he's in charge of another continent. It's crazy. It actually is crazy. And then you have to, you know, you keep traveling, you have to struggle with something called jet lag.
Yeah,
you can't figure what, whether it's night or day. Like I arrived here in Australia and I felt it was the middle of the night when it was 12 o'clock midday. And the devotees were saying, why are you so tired? Well, because my body wanted to go to sleep. So, I mean, there's all these different factors there. It's not so good for the health either.
Well, that's why I mentioned it, that I used to travel a lot, but now I don't have any desire.
Yeah.
I'd rather just stay in one place.
And that's better. You can accomplish much more by staying in one place. But somehow or other, Prabhupada's put me in this situation where I have to do what I have to do. You know, somehow or other, I'm in a situation where I have responsibilities, I have disciples in different places, but long term, not good. But for me, you know, I'm trapped. It's life. I come here to see Dwarkadesh, you know. If I didn't come here, how could I see him? What do they say? If Muhammad won't go to the mountain, the mountain will have to go to Muhammad. Did you ever hear that saying before? So he won't come to see me, so I have to go to see him. What can I do? He's been promising all these years to visit me, but never has.
He
doesn't even have a dhoti. So he's a renouncer. Even when he went to India, he didn't want to see me. I had to force him to travel so many hours to see me for, what, a half an hour or something like that.
In Tirupati.
So, any other questions? Comments? We should take prasad now? Oh, yeah.
I was just going to say the airlines make it sound glamorous traveling around the world, but in reality, it's not, is it?
It's not. It's definitely not glamorous. I mean, being cooped up in a 14-hour plane flight from, you know, Los Angeles to Sydney, it's just not glamorous. I mean, it's not... I mean, what do you... Of course, I bring my electronic gadgets so I can read Prabhupada's books, I can listen to things. I have a way of dealing with it. When everybody else is sleeping, I'm standing up and chanting japa. And when everyone else is eating, I'm sleeping. So I sort of reversed the pattern there. And I was actually interesting. I was on the plane. I was chanting japa. I was just standing up chanting japa. And the stewardess thought I had injured my hand. And I had an ice pack on my hands. She said, "We want more ice for your ice pack." So, you know, it's all... I say, "I'm chanting Hare Krishna," like that. So, you know, there are certain circumstances that arise, and sometimes opportunities to preach Krishna consciousness, but it is quite austere.
It's a lot of money, too.
Yeah.
Most of the, you know, with families, it's very difficult to afford to go overseas with your families.
With the families, you can't do it. You know, sometimes people ask, you know, why don't you take a servant with you? I said, two things. First of all, it's too expensive. And secondly, that means it would be like having a baby with me. Because I usually do everything for myself. I said, I'm not going to babysit for someone. So the time someone has traveled with me, it's just, I have to worry, where's your passport, little boy? Have you eaten? Why are you getting sick? You know, because it's enough worrying about yourself and worrying about someone else. That's why I don't travel with anyone. You know, if later on in life I'm not able to take care of myself, that's another thing. But anyway, it's austere. It's definitely austere, and you're with people right next to you are eating meat, and then sometimes there's a lady with a little baby changing the diapers right next to you, and she gives you the kid to hold while she's changing the diapers. It's very austere. Things that happen, I mean, I can tell you all the things that happened to me on the airplanes like that. So, but, you know, it's a sacrifice, but it's long-term, you're right. And long-term, people are not going to be traveling, you know, as global warming and they're using the Earth's resources. It's not going to be so easy to travel, let's say, 50 years from now. Unless they have tunnels, you know, under the Earth, you know, like Robin had. You know, like pneumatic tunnels, you can just put yourself... They're actually designing something like that to go between San Francisco and Los Angeles, a pneumatic tunnel.
Capsules.
You heard about that before? And then, anyway, it's just not natural. It's just not natural. One should, remain in one place and train up people. The guru's position should generally be to have an ashram where he can train people up in Krishna consciousness. And that's the ideal situation. Thank you for asking those questions. I think it's time for prasadam, right? Because it's late. Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.